Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone? Welcome to the Twilight Zone. This is episode number 7.
Six, I think.
Six, you think? All right. So this is episode number 6, he thinks. It's as though he told me earlier and I immediately forgot because whatever. So we are doing 2 episodes of the Twilight Zone Zone like we do every week on the Twilight Zone Zone. And we do the Twilight Zone Zone and actually get it out the week it's supposed to be out on the Twilight Zone Zone. We're doing episode Eye of the Beholder and 22. It's been, it feels like it's been so long, I've forgotten how I do this. So it's been a weird few weeks, guys. I just finished finals. So with that in mind, on panel tonight we have...
Hello, this is Daniel, a contributor to Poptos and somebody who's going to get a butt lift tomorrow at the hospital.
There you go. And on panel we have...
Jeremy, and I only watched one of the episodes. I blame that on the virus.
That's right. Yes. It's totally fine. There's so many things we can blame for a bad podcast that we're trying to put together. So, so we started out with Eye of the Beholder, number 22, also titled The Private World of Darkness, when it was originally rebroadcast the summer of 1962, apparently. Thanks to Wikipedia.
Is that Eye of the Beholder?
Yeah.
Wow.
Eye of the Beholder is a better title.
Yeah.
Although I guess it kind of gives away the twist. Whatever.
There's a lot that actually gives it away, but we'll get into that.
This might be the most dancing around the premise of any of these episodes we've kind of gotten to.
Well, it also doesn't work in high def because there's a reason why, and we'll get to that.
All right.
I just don't want to jump ahead.
No, you're fine. So this is also written by Rod Serling. Not Rod Sterling, as you guys corrected me time and time again. Rod Serling. With music by Bernard Herrmann, because I guess he was available today. But I will give you the opening narration, as we always do. Then we'll kind of get into it. Jeremy, you can give us our plot synopsis here in a second. Okay. Suspended in time and space... Sorry, I gotta do the voice. Suspended in time and space for a moment. Your introduction to Miss Janet Tyler, who lives in a very private world of darkness. A universe whose dimensions are size and thickness and length of the swarm of bandages that cover her face. In a moment, we will go back into this room. And also, in a moment, we will look under those bandages. Keeping in mind, of course, that we are not to be surprised by what we see, because this just isn't a hospital. And this patient 307 is not just a woman. This happens to be the Twilight Zone. And Miss Janet Tyler, with you, is about to enter it. So, Jeremy, why don't you give us the plot of this?
So, the plot, it's pretty thin, but I don't mean that in a negative sense. The Miss Tyler is in a hospital bed, completely bandaged. We don't see her at all. And she's basically, most of the time, saying how she hopes this is the operation that finally makes her beautiful. And we find out it's the 11th time she's had this. And she's basically going insane at the thought of what she'll look like when the bandages finally come off.
This episode, again, has, like you said, it's kind of a thin premise compared to some of these other ones. Only one real twist, which happens bizarrely near the end for this.
I mean, I think most people know the twist of this. It's that the woman's actually strikingly beautiful and everybody else is hideously deformed with, like, piggish noses and protruded lips, and it's great makeup, but that's what's going on here.
Yeah, these are the ones with all the pig people.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, like, as we kind of go through this, this one doesn't have too many twists and turns other than the whole thing is filmed in this weird shadow the whole time.
You only see Rod Serling's face at the beginning and until the end.
No. That monster.
Yes.
That horrifying beast.
Who supposedly was burned out of existence in a previous episode.
Yeah, I mean, how better to end season one than kill your annoying narrator?
I'll do it.
Who? I mean, you want to talk about a hard living. I mean, the guy was like 25 when he made this or whatever. Mercy me. You know, let's get through this just a little bit here, because...
Well, one of the things about it is apparently this is a society that's all about conformity, and its standards of beauty are actually mandated by law. At least that's what it's implied. And this is supposedly the last visit that Janet can have at the hospital before she's essentially sent away to a concentration camp for other ugly people.
Yeah, that was the big thing about this episode is the symbolism of all the conformity stuff was kind of lost on me. I mean, it was too overt to be, I guess, metaphorical. It was...
Surprise Hitler.
Yeah, like...
I mean, like, Pig Hitler here is really... It's quite a twist in the second act. Mm-hmm. This whole thing is weird. Okay, so I guess we should kind of smash cut Rod Serling. Followed by a woman in a dark hospital room. It's all filmed very Dutch angle-y, a lot of shadows, a lot of long, weird kind of in-between shot. It feels almost like a post-war German horror movie or something.
Yeah,
like,
you're not wrong.
But like as done by Tim Burton, because the doors are kind of askew as though you're in a funhouse. It's a very interesting aesthetic.
Well, there's really no difference between a post-war German horror movie and a Tim Burton movie.
What am I thinking of? Like Dr. Mabuso or something like that?
That
like,
pre-war German
that's
movie.
Pre-war, yes. And M is also pre-war. Mm-hmm. But she is in this hospital bed. She's begging the nurses to give her good news. And they're like, look, we got to wait for the doctor. He'll be in shortly, blah, blah, blah. They go back to the nurse's station. They're like, wow, what an ugly woman.
Yeah.
My goodness, how ugly is she?
Well, we also get some interesting dialogue from the woman because she's afraid of being sent away to wherever this place for ugly people is. And one of the lines, which I don't even think many shows these days would try, is something like this, her saying, the state is not God.
That's something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Apparently, there's 11 surgeries for treatment, as Jeremy mentioned, and this is the maximum amount. So I don't know what these surgeries are, but it seems like they have a pretty high failure rate because this island is filled with people.
Yeah. Well, they also never explain, like, what happened to everyone else or, like, what the divergence is.
Well, I mean, it's supposed to be about segregation
or the
Holocaust or whatever.
Or,
I was thinking like communism.
I was thinking more of black families moving into white neighborhoods in the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, it's this. You are genetically different. Mm-hmm. We don't know why. We've tried to make you more like us, but you'll never conform, so we've got to send you away. And you're right. So it could be gulags. It could be, you know, pick your poison. We do have a very kind of Big Brother-esque video that plays about halfway through, which is something.
Now, this is where I said that this doesn't work in high def, and that's why, because the video is supposed to be obscured, right?
It is not.
It's not. I mean, like, back when it initially aired, there would have been no way to tell what the leader looked like, but in high def, it's like, okay, he's got a piggish nose, his eyes are sunken in.
To be fair, when you were watching it on your 24-inch TV, he probably was 6 pixels.
Right. Like, well, I do admire, though, that they were willing to go to that level of detail. I mean, it would just been easier not to put him in makeup at all, or, like, shoot him entirely in shadow, and they don't do that, because it wouldn't make sense... the context of the scene, so well done.
To the same wit, to that point, we do have, like, I don't know how much any of this crap costs, because it's 1961, so it could be shockingly expensive. We're still a year away from Star Trek, and I've watched some of those original bleep globs, and they're terrible.
Oof.
Like, but I mean, you know, I guess that's not true. I think it's 66 is Star Trek.
I think so.
But whatever. It's just filmed in a hospital, which is so terrifying, right? Like, it's the same way that Kubrick uses the never-ending hallways for terror. Because as she, at one point, like, tries to escape, and she just kind of gets lost in the halls of this massive, generic, horrifying, bland building.
I also kind of really thought that the doctor's performance was subtly horrifying, because he wasn't malicious. He genuinely was trying to care for his patient, but... You know, in between his lines of dialogue when he's talking about how it's important that everyone conforms, you could really, I don't know, I thought that was terrifying because he's being so nice, but at the same time so evil.
Call the guard. Call the security guard. Yes, you're totally fine. Call someone! And he's talking through his angry teeth.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you want to talk about 1950s and 60s filming? They had to make sure that the mask could allow everyone to smoke. Did you notice that? Like, no. They had a curled up lip so you could get a cigarette in there. I was just like,
I never put two and two together on that, but you are right.
A nice highball glass as well. Just like, all right, we need to make sure that they know they're doctors. So they have to be able to smoke and drink whiskey while they're performing surgery. What do we got? Ah, yes. The old Elvis mask that melted slightly.
Yeah. That is the best description of those faces I've ever heard.
Because it's got the kind of curled lip up, and you're just like,
curled lip, yep.
Anyway, so Janet has her head completely bandaged. She describes herself as having a twisted, pitiful lump of flesh,
yep.
Which is something.
And David Cronenberg heard that, and that was his first ever erection.
I was going to say, I bet I could make it look worse. All right, David, calm down. Greg Nicotero, someone just like, I can make it worse. You go back to your corner, buddy. Anyway, everyone's, and again, about halfway through, I mean, yes, when you see the pictures, just look it up, just Google it. You'll recognize this episode because you've seen the masks. But even if you've never, ever seen this before, about a third of the way in, you'll be like, dude, they're not showing anyone else's faces.
Yep. Yeah.
And even other nurses, you see like the women at the nurse station, it's all from the bridge of their nose up. Right?
Yep.
About halfway in, you kind of get that itch in the back of your head. She's been given a procedure which God knows what it's supposed to do, but it does literally nothing. And she has no scars on her face.
No change at all.
Yeah. Which is just something. I don't know how you screw up plastic surgery so that there's no change.
That's...
She's more horrible and beautiful than whatever.
That's kind of interesting, though, because it makes me think that what's happening isn't necessarily a genetic difference. It's that everybody who looks like the doctors and the nurses deliberately chose to undergo that procedure and it worked.
Possibly. I mean, shockingly, this does something very good, which you would hate in most things, but it doesn't bother to explain a damn thing, which probably saves it, because this could be a whole lot of talky talk and then you miss having any moral.
Well, it kind of is a whole lot of talky talk, but the talky talk works because it's so vague enough that it's all just about conformity.
If you summarize the whole thing, it's three paragraphs. The first paragraph is just like, I sure hope I'm not ugly anymore. Oh, I sure hope I'm not ugly anymore. And then they eventually take off the bandages. The doctor comes in. Well, actually, I think the doctor comes in first and she's like panicking. She wants to she wants the bandages off to see what happened. Blah, blah, blah. He's very empathetic, like you said, and it makes it much more unsettling. And then they take off the bandages, and I believe that's the commercial break because everyone screams.
Yeah.
and then we enter the second act, and we have kind of a cool reverse shot where they're peeling the bandages off the camera.
Yep.
So you kind of gradually come into focus.
The light gets, you can gradually see the light, and then you can see some of the surrounding things that Janet would be seeing.
Right. A nurse screams, people are shocked how ugly she is, but we finally get the vision of her, and I mean, as you guys alluded to, she's just a she looks like any number of 50s actresses. She's beautiful, but she has the blonde, the kind of curly hair. Has she been in anything that we recognize?
I don't know.
Name didn't seem familiar.
No, I mean, she's kind of a TV actress from the 50s, which means she didn't actually ever cross over into movies, really, because back then they didn't.
Yeah.
But she was also in The Outer Limits. She was in Trapper John M.D., Judging Amy, Chicago Hope, The Wonder Years. So she worked up until 2000.
Oh, good.
She died in 2013 at the age of 94.
Wow.
Jesus. Wow.
Anyway, I mean, she's fine in this. She has, in some ways, she has very little to do.
You know, I've mentioned it on some past episodes, the UPN revival that they tried to do with the Korn guitarist doing the theme and Forest Whitaker as the host.
You sure did.
And they only ever, I think, did a couple remakes. I can only think of two offhand. One of them was Monsters Are Doing Maple Street, which we've referenced, and the other one was this one.
It
was terrible because they didn't change a damn thing about it.
And again, it's that whole fucking, what is that movie? A Time to Kill, Matthew McConaughey, And is it Samuel L. Jackson? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Time to Kill?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's just like, the whole thing is like, and now pretend they were white. And you're just like, oh, it's smart now. Because it's kind of about racism.
Yep.
But it's so on the nose, right? It almost, at the end, feels like one of those spooky door riffs from Futurama. We're like, surprise, it was man all along. And you're just like, all right, we get it. We get it. It's about black people and white people or whatever.
You know,
you can sit back down.
Rod Serling also, I think, wrote the first draft of Planet of the Apes back when they were making
that. Rod Serling did that.
I'm pretty sure.
I mean, I'm not going to argue. It seems right up his alley. Just there with a cigarette. What's the twist? It was Earth all along, and the rest writes itself. And you're just like, okay, Rod. Oh, man. People must have smelled terrible in the 50s. Just all that smoke the time. Eating nothing but canned food. Oh, man, what a time to be alive. And yet somehow they were thinner than us. and yet, it was all the cigarettes. It keeps you from getting hungry.
Appetite suppressant. This is a great episode of The Twilight Zone, and there's a reason it's become so famous to the point where I'm pretty sure there was an action figure made of the Doctor. That was
what,
like,
are you talking about?
I swear, I was like in a... Jesus, like 15, 20 years ago, I swear I was in a Suncoast at the mall, and they had like the Doctor action figure with the curled lip.
You mentioned four things in a row that don't exist anymore.
I know.
Sunco, malls, action figures of obscure 50s TV shows. What a world you come from.
There was also a Mr. Creosote doll there.
of course there was.
You squeezed it, and then it would vomit.
Oh, God help us.
Have they made Funko Pops of those yet?
I'm sure it's coming.
Oh, man. What are these days? We're just going to have a refuse pile of Funko Pops.
No.
But, I mean, it's a great episode, but, I mean, I'm wondering how much of the impact's gone now that everybody knows what the twist is.
I will say she's good in this. She's fine in this. It's a random episode from 1960 of TV. She is stage acting the hell out of this. It's, like, over the top. It's like, my goodness! And she's running down the hallway like she's about to faint with her hand to her forehead the whole time. And again, to your credit, I know why you thought of the Planet of the Apes, because these people look like they're wearing bad ape masks.
Yeah.
But they committed. They must have made 50 of these fuckers, because everyone they come across is wearing one of these things.
Yep.
Every nurse, every other patient, like random dudes leaning out of their room to see what's going on.
And the leader on the TV screen that would have definitely been obscured.
So after the bandages are gone, she's beautiful, blah, blah, blah.
She meets a man. Well, the doctor introduces her to another ugly person who's, you know, this incredibly handsome 50s man. Like, you could pretty much just slap a label on him that says 1959, and that's pretty much who he is.
Mr. 1959. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who wants to boogie with baby 59? And he's talking about, well, you know, where we're going, beauty really is in the eye of the beholder, and you'll be treated well and all that.
Yeah, and it's literally like an island of ugly people that they're going to, or whatever
this is. It's literally a concentration camp or like a prison colony.
Well, I think they call it a ghetto.
I think so, yeah.
I mean, I'm just like, we get it, Rod. You can pull it. No, we've got to make sure they get this premise, damn it. No, Rod. Someone get him another highball. He needs to sit back down.
He's already had four. He'll be fine.
I was going to say, meanwhile, I guess he steps out of one of these other surgery rooms. He's only on surgery number 8 or whatever. And we get our final narration. Unless you got something else.
I really don't. Jeremy, do you?
No. I mean, I'm wondering when they go to the island or whatever it is that they go to, do they all know they're ugly if they all look the same? Is that another symbolic point?
I think the point is they've been exiled deliberately, so they're at least aware they don't conform to society.
We're talking about, like, the dude on the TV is giving, like, a very kind of fiery, these are the other, like, I mean, he's this close to calling the island they're being sent away to Israel. Like, it's really awkward. It's so, like, it's so concentration campy, and they're all being sent away, and everyone's fine with it.
Now, I actually do have a question for Jeremy and you before we get to the final narration. I know in the past we've talked about, like, when the first time we ever saw this was, like, be it on the Sci-Fi Channel on New Year's. Was this the first time you had seen it, Jeremy?
If I had seen it, I was a kid. So I was able to pick up the twist just from, you know, figuring, you know, okay, why aren't they showing everyone's face rather than, oh, yeah, I remember this. So, yeah, I want to say this was my first time. Yeah,
I think I'd seen it before, but I forget, like, when and where. But it was one of those things that I'm pretty sure The Simpsons or Futurama spoofed at one point.
Well, I mean, it's like The Brady Bunch. I don't know if I've ever seen an episode of The Brady Bunch, ugh, but I know what The Brady Bunch is. Right?
Yeah.
Like, this is kind of one of those ones that's so ubiquitous that it's in the cultural zeitgeist. So, like, have I seen it? Who knows? But I know this episode.
Sure.
Right? Like, again, it's something that the Futurama probably riffed on because they did that Spooky Door show. The Simpsons may or may not have done it. It's also kind of sort of the Island of Dr. Moreau, that horrible version that...
with Marlon Brando.
Right? Like, I'm making people more beautiful by making them animals. And you're just like, all right, weird fat person with a tiny person.
Other way around. He's making animals into people.
Yes. Okay, fine. Whatever. Who cares? This is all nonsense. We will do that one day on the main feed, and it will be awful.
Oof.
It will be awful. It's a bad movie. It is a bad movie.
Can I just rewatch that Richard Stanley documentary again about what he was going to do and then how he got fired after 3 days?
Yeah. There's a lot of coulda, woulda, shouldas. I mean, and again, it's a property that would be fine in the right hands. Is it a 50s version or a 60s version of the Island of Dr. Moreau?
There is a 30s version.
Island of Lost Souls, I believe it was called.
And that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
That was a troubled production. But that one came out in, what, 94, 95?
Somewhere around there.
Like that, yeah.
The Island of Dr. Hibbert. Closing narration. Now, the question that comes to mind, where is this place and when is it? What kind of world where ugliness is the norm and beauty is the deviation from that norm? You want an answer? The answer is it doesn't make any difference. What a fucking cop-out. I'm sorry, I don't...
That's not part of the narration.
No. Because the old saying happens to be true. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In this year or 100 years hence, on this planet or wherever there is human life, perhaps out amongst the stars, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Lessons to be learned in the Twilight Zone. Pretty good. Oh, shit. I misread something. There's two different actresses. One that was wearing bandages and one that wasn't. And the one that wasn't was Donna Douglas, who plays Ella Mae Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, wow.
So she is someone who became something. And then when she stopped acting in 70s, it looks like, she became a real estate agent and a gospel speaker, singer, and an inspirational speaker. So there we go. She had her own Twilight Zone moment. It's weird to look up these actors and actresses from the 50s and 60s because it often mentions where they're buried now. You're just like, that's fine.
You know, this next one's got a great little guest star.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
All right, we're back. Episode... blah, 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 blah. 17 of season 2 or 22. This one doesn't have an alternate title, which they tried in syndication. That didn't work. But it does come from a story called The Bus Conductor from the Pall Mall magazine. Whatever.
Everyone in the 50s was smoking like a chimney.
Yeah, this is also, I guess, fun fact. This is one of 6 episodes shot on videotape in a short-lived experiment to cut costs.
Oh, well.
Whatever that means. Oh, God, help me. So, I will give the opening narration. Danny, you can give us the plot synopsis.
Okay.
This is Miss Liz Powell. She's a professional dancer, and she's in the hospital as a result of overwork and nervous fatigue. And at this moment, we have just finished walking with her in a nightmare. In a moment, she'll wake up, and we will remain by her side. The problem here is that both Miss Powell and you will reach the point where it might be difficult to decide which is reality and which is nightmare. A problem uncommon, perhaps, but rather peculiar. to the Twilight Zone.
The plot's pretty simple in this one. It's about Liz, the dancer, who's having this recurring nightmare where she's walking through the hospital to the morgue, which just happens to be room number 22, hence the title of the episode. And this nurse comes out and asks her, well, doesn't ask her, but tells her, room for one more, honey. And then she runs away and then wakes up and she starts talking to it with her doctor, who is... For Freakazoid fans, he was the guy. He's played by the guy who was once in a TV show with a robot. So there you go. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to put it together. And it's like, oh, well, she actually knows the hospital grounds layout, even though she's never actually been to these areas of our building. So what's going on here? And it's all about whether or not her dream is going to come true and whether or not she's going to die.
And to get this woman who's playing a... exotic dancer is a woman named Barbara Nichols. Is this who you had a story about? No, it was the Freakazoid guy, right?
Yeah.
She is someone who you might not know unless you know 40s films very well. But she was kind of a huge deal at the time. They said she was a rival to Marilyn Monroe, which who knows. But she kind of died young. If you've seen the original Pajama Game, she's in that. She's in The Sweet Smell of Success. She's in The Naked and the Dead.
Oh.
And she was played alongside A-listers, even though she might not have been one. She's in movies with Sophia Loren, Doris Day, Clark Gable. And then she died in her 40s when half of her organs apparently ruptured, I guess.
Oof.
Liver failure due to complications of a damaged spleen, which had... whatever. Weird story. But... again, she's just like your standard kind of 50s, 60s blonde bombshell type.
I thought she looked a lot like Marion Crane. That's something I got in my notes, which makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and subsequently she appeared in everything that required a blonde bombshell type in the 50s and 60s, including, again, Batman, Star Trek, Hawaii Five-0, Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, The Untouchables, Jack Benny, like everything. But there you have it. Yeah, we can kind of walk through this. She's an overworked... professional dancer, where as she's trying to recuperate, she keeps having this same nightmare over and over again, as you kind of alluded to. And every time, like, she's kind of like in bed, thrashes, breaks a glass. When she breaks the glass, she gets up and walks down a long hallway. The question is, of course, what is real, what is a dream, etc., etc.
You're right, first and foremost. Looking at my notes again, they do openly refer to her as a stripper. That wasn't just guessing on our part.
Yeah, no, it's weird. Which makes it kind of a weirdly... because everyone's, like, talking down to this woman in a weird way. I mean, it's the 60s. Like, I'm surprised they didn't smack her on the ass as she left the room.
Well, they kind of treat her badly, though, throughout the entire thing, because there's that one bit where they're, like, going, well, if you feel the compulsion to have that nightmare again, just don't do it.
That's right. They also have... they call her agent, but it's like the guy who runs the strip club keeps coming in.
Oh, yeah. The guy who keeps referring to her as Kitten or something?
Yeah, Kitten, which is something. A guy named, I think his name is Barney. He's played by an actor named Fred Wayne. And he is just, again, practically smacking her in the ass as she walks on. He wants her to get back to the strip club, so...
Later, of course, this is the same guy who would shoot Lee Harvey Oswald as he was being let out from the Dallas police station.
Yeah, thank you. It's only 3 years away. It's hard to... it's crazy that we get to see the future like that.
Well, and it was interesting how you brought up this was a videotaped episode, because this was another thing I had in my notes. First, I'd never seen this one before. So, okay. Like, with Eye of the Beholder, I was aware of it. This one, I had no idea what it was. But it looks terrible. Like, not just from an aesthetic standpoint, but the film just looks so worn out.
A lot of the weird dramatic shots that we've gotten in every other episode, I guess there is a cinematic quality to them that I would not have put my finger on, but all of this is framed very flat.
Yes.
You know, like, so at one point, turns out that one of the nurse from the dream that says room for one more is just a day nurse that day because she switched shifts with someone,
mm-hmm.
and that she should have never been seen before by the patient. But when the reveal happens, again, if this was Eye of the Beholder, it would have been a weird Dutch angle. The door frame would have been slightly askew so that there would have been a huge shadow cast across her. So it would have been more dramatic. this is literally just like a woman in a doorway and you're perfectly in frame. It's very weird. It even follows the rules of three, which you don't do with a dramatic reveal.
Yeah.
Very bizarre.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of this that's bizarre. By the way, I'll go ahead and say it since we already talked about the woman. Her doctor that's like coming up to her is Jonathan Harris, who is famous. Well, later in his career, he was a voiceover actor, but he's probably most famous for being in Lost in Space as Dr. Smith.
That's right. It's crazy. I mean, I guess there's a type here, but there's a lot of before they were famous. Again, we skipped a Shatner episode. We're going to get to Nightmare at 20,000 Feet here in a next week. We're going to skip ahead. We have a guest coming in. It's cool. It's good casting. These are good actors and actresses who get, which again, I guess lets you know that this was something. I don't know what it was to the people at the time, but
I mean, it was obviously popular enough to go on for what, 5 seasons,
something like that. And by the end, it apparently had gotten real crap. But you know, when Rod Serling is the guy who's writing almost all the episodes, eventually you burn out.
Well, I mean, he was already kind of burned out with this because they show that nightmare twice.
In full.
Yeah.
And then she kind of lives it out loud, right? She runs down the hallway and she goes to that room and she ends up at the doorway and then she's like, I've got to get out of here. And you're just like, oh, all right. I mean, you're talking about walking in circles, especially since the big dramatic reveal eventually is that she's just not going to have that nightmare and doesn't knock the glass off the nightstand and then does it again accidentally.
Yep.
Of course she does.
Well, they kind of fake it out, like I was saying, because Jonathan Harris is talking to the nurse going, oh, well, she shouldn't know where the morgue in this hospital is.
Did you pull something?
Yes, probably.
But the other thing, which is funny, is you and Jeremy and I had been talking before about the idea of a female horror movie. Like, what's the thing? This is very much that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong. No one is believing me, and they're condescending to me because I'm a woman, right? It's Invisible Man. It's Carrie.
Rosemary's Baby.
We were talking Roman Polanski. I'm like, why was I thinking about Rosemary's Baby not long ago?
Yeah, that's a different female horror movie is Roman Polanski right there.
He did Rosemary's Baby, though,
yes,
right?
He did.
And that's 70s?
68.
Wow. He's been working forever.
Yeah. I think his first thing was in 61.
He keeps getting older. The girls keep staying the same age.
Oh, God. Oh, God. We just went there.
All right. Anyway, after a week's worth of rest and apparently faking it, who knows, she gets released from the hospital.
She's a stripper. She's used to faking it.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry, that completely brain no working. And then she gets discharged from the hospital. She decides to, like, take a vacation to Miami or something like that.
Well,
right?
She gets discharged, and then, again, the doctor comes in. It's like, okay, now they were just dreams. You're okay. Even though he'd already pointed out how weird some of this stuff was. It's like, why are they so interested in gaslighting her?
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, we don't know if this is supposed to be real or a dream, but because it is not well filmed, it doesn't look like everything is the same. The dream is clearly night. Everything else is happening during the day. We don't know. And then in a twist that is right out of Final Destination, because mm-hmm. of course we're here.
Yeah.
She gets to the airport, buys a ticket, because you could just do that back then, walk up to the gate and buy a ticket. And the flight number is flight 22.
And then when she's entering the flight, the stewardess comes out and is like, room for one more, honey.
And then she runs screaming down the stairs. It's the craziest thing.
Well, and then the plane takes off and it explodes. Just Final Destination.
Exactly. You know what this should have been? Take this away. Add an emotional man and a strong woman, and this is an X-Files episode.
Yeah.
Right? A woman is convinced she's going to die. She's attacked several nurses or something, right? Maybe even killed the doctor, and they now have a restraint, and she's like, they're trying to kill me, and then the plane explodes? That's how you do this. But as it is, it's just like, hey, Toots, you're crazy.
Yep.
Look at those cans. They need to be back on the runway.
I do like one part. I do like one part of this is that the nurse in the dream is the same actress that's playing the flight attendant when she's about to board the plane.
She got two checks that week.
She did.
Oh, God. I mean, the problem is with this episode, and it's not bad. It's a good episode. I need an antagonist. I need someone. Like, you're right. Even the doctor's kind of like, meh, who knows? And, like, the manager. Jack Ruby just wants her to get back to work so he can go around trying to kill presidential assassins. But in the meantime, she's just kind of, you know, being taken advantage of. She's doing fine. There's just nothing to this episode.
Yeah. I have no idea why this was considered one of the best ones.
I think she should have broken out of the hospital earlier. And then when she gets to the airport, there's more things that start to break apart. First, she sees a guy wearing, like, a white lab coat at the airport bar or something. And then there's a guy who looks like the doctor who doesn't recognize her. Like, you can build that up more. Meanwhile, the last scene takes about 3 minutes.
And even then, in the airport, as everything's breaking apart, it can go back to her being wheeled into the morgue. It's like, oh, well, she was under anesthesia this whole time and she died in surgery. There's the twist.
Or anything. It's straightforward. The twist is fine, but the plane explosion doesn't have much impact at the end. It's more like, huh, oh, no, yeah. Okay, hey, look at that. I'm sure she'll be fine because of this.
And then, well, it's her, like, the plane's exploding in the background, and she's back in the airport, and she's, like, quivering with fear, and then it explodes, and that's the end.
Which, I mean, I guess it's better than... It's efficient storytelling, because then immediately the narration comes in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I can give you. Miss Elizabeth Powell, professional dancer. Hospital diagnosis, acute anxiety brought on by overwork and fatigue. Prognosis, with rest and care, she'll probably recover. But the cure to some nightmares is not to be found in known medical journals. You look it under potions for bad dreams, to be found in the Twilight Zone. I mean, again, I want to be there one day. You know, if I could go back in time, just to be on that office and probably like the third floor of some studio lot, right? In an office where he's just there with a tumbler of whiskey typing this stuff. Because, man, this is where his best writing comes from. Like, because a lot of his dialogue is fairly stilted, but this stuff is like, what am I going to get to say with my silver tongue here? It's good. Yeah. Like, this stuff is good. You almost, just me reading it, I get a little spine tingle sometimes, because it's really good stuff. Anyway, are there final thoughts on this one?
I mean, we usually do the comparison between the two, which Eye of the Beholder definitely is the better episode of these two. This one's just kind of bland. There's really not a whole lot interesting going on here. It's like, well, we talked about Rod Serling phoning it in. He's got like a first draft. It's like, meh, good enough.
I know, Jeremy. Would you recommend Eye of the Beholder to anyone?
I would. I think the big draw for me in the episode, you know, even though I figured out the twist like a third of the way in, aesthetically, it's fun to watch. You see how they mask everyone's face. You know, a character will move across the screen and then the camera will move with him, but it'll just happen to be behind someone's head, so even though they're moving, it's elaborate yet not elaborate, and it's just really clever in that regard.
I will say I like that episode more because it has a game to it, right? Because the twist is a stupid twist, right?
Yeah.
She's beautiful, my God, everyone else is a chud person. But, like, the game then is, as a director, how do you frame 400 shots where you don't see the twist?
Yeah.
Because the twist is always there. Like, the doctor has very distinct ears, but that's not really playing into it until you see the mask, right? This one, there's no game to it. Like, it would be great if there's another woman in a straitjacket being hauled away. Like, no, I'm telling you, this is what's going to happen. It's not a dream. It's reality. This is because, like, is this the second episode? Is it about someone who can see the future? Is it someone cheating death? Who knows? They didn't seem to think that far ahead. I do think I know why this is a classic. First of all, that plane explosion effect is great. It's a good, subtle end. There's not too many Twilight Zone endings that end that abruptly. Even Time Enough at Last, we sit with that poor man as his soul is crushed. Because that you have Burgess Meredith going, there was time now, and there's like 95 seconds of this man's entire world falling apart.
Yeah.
Which I've been on the floor of the bathroom crying to myself. I know what that's like. But like this, it's
I call
just,
that Wednesday.
That's right. And this, like, she runs back into the lounge. Like, again, you see people at a bar behind her, people looking out the window in front of her, and then all of a sudden it was like a kid with a firecracker lighting a fuse. Because this thing, she's like crying on the floor, and then kaboom, and you're just like, alrighty. But I would say you still should watch this episode. It's something. But the other one's a little bit better. Now, I will tell you, the next episode is going to be a little bit different. As you know, we've been doing these chronologically. If you've even told you the list we're going off of, which is Vanity Fair's, the 26 episodes to watch when you think of the Twilight Zone. Or sorry, the 26 episode you're thinking of when you think of the Twilight Zone. We've been doing them in pairs, which means the next two should be from season two. But we're going to skip ahead. We're going to have a guest on. Ben Wooster, who you might know from Hooked on TJ Hooker, his old show, Blame It on Our Space. He's also an occasional guest on We Hate Movies. Because of his Hooked on TJ Hooker show, we're going to skip ahead to the fifth season so we can talk about Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, starring one Sir William Shatner. And it is opposite The Living Doll, starring Telly Savalas and Talking Tina. Next week, instead, listen to this. And of course, we will continue to do this as long as COVID-19 exists. So we'll be doing it for the next 3 years. Daniel and I have already figured out the next spinoff show that we can do.
Yep.
Since we will probably be, even if this ends during the summer, we'll be back in the fall doing extra episodes. I can virtually guarantee it. Thanks for listening. And we'll return next week for the Twilight Zone. Zone. The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is Six Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Sterling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.